Greetings, everyone, from Central Virginia. Here's another Talk History episode. Today we're going to cover episodes 62 and 63, so I'll just call this 63B, if that's okay with everyone. My guest today isn't a history podcaster like I've had before and ones I'll have in the future, but he was involved in a project that involved two topics closest to my heart, World War II and sci-fi. How could we not meet? So with us today is Luke Whitehorn. How are you doing today, Luke?
I'm not too bad, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm doing okay. And Luke was involved in the movie Iron Sky. I hope you checked it out. I hope you got a chance to see it. But he was involved in the, and I'm not sure what you call it over there. I'll just, on this side of the pond, I'll just say special effects. Yeah, does that sound right?
Visual effects.
Visual effects. Yeah. I'm terribly sorry.
Don't worry.
Okay, good. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement in that movie?
Okay. I was part of the visual effects team that worked out of a small town called Tampere in Finland. Finland was where all the visual effects were done. And I guess the visual effects of the film were split roughly into sort of two categories, I suppose you could call them. One of those was what's called set extensions. And because the film was done on such a small budget, what they actually did was they just built the set in about a 5-meter radius around the actors, and everything else that you see is computer generated.
Wow.
Yeah, which is some pretty cool work. But I didn't do that part of the stuff, that part of the visual effects. I did the spaceships flying around and shooting and exploding and things like that. So
that was the best part. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I thought. It was the most difficult part.
And they can check out some of your work at lukewhitehorn.com. See some of the photos and stuff like that. I think I was looking at it.
Yeah, that'll have my latest showreel on and a breakdown of some visual effects. However, it does contain spoilers. So if anyone out there is tempted to actually see the film, see that film first before you go to my site. Otherwise,
there, you've been warned. Exactly.
Yes,
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. And I also want to second your motion earlier about the fact that I'm not a history podcaster. I am, in this aspect anyway, I'm just professionally some guy that you know. So prepare for me to potentially say very stupid things.
That's okay. It'll just make me look even smarter, which is, you know, the only reason I need to have you on. But, you know, it's my show. I can do whatever I want. No, but you and I think you listened to some of the podcasts. You emailed me and we had a conversation going. And so you have a love of history and that kind of thing. And I just thought it would be neat to go in a different angle and just bring someone on almost like a listener, but a well-informed listener. Not that I would be opposed to having a listener on the Talk History in the future. I think that could be pretty cool. But so I just wanted to go in a little bit different direction. So that's why I contacted you and asked you to be with us today.
You should try that 1 week. Have an ill-informed listener on.
There we go. I would come across as totally brilliant. But anyway, so you've listened to episode 62 and 63.
Yes. So
where would you like to just jump in and start?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, one of the things that stuck in my mind was it was Graziani. That guy, or just, I'm not sure whether it's Graziani himself or the Italians generally, but it was his exceptionally timid advance into Egypt is still, it's quite astounding how much he didn't advance. I mean, he was pretty much browbeaten by Mussolini into advancing as far as he did, was it like 62 miles or something like that?
Right.
At which point he was just like, oh, no, I simply must stop because, you know, it's weird to think how he could have not at least, like, want to try and emulate his German counterparts or because clearly that was the way to actually win victories was to sort of storm through your enemy. I mean, especially if you outnumber them so greatly. However, yeah. he also did have maybe good reason because I was reading on Wikipedia, I'm afraid to say. Sorry, everyone. just about Graziani himself. And I'm not sure whether he was completely incompetent or just erring on the side of caution, perhaps a bit too much. But he knew that his force was not quite as mechanized as his British counterparts, even though the number disparity was great in terms of infantry.
Right.
I think maybe he was worried about his equipment or simply not being able to make a dent in the British line. It's difficult to tell because he never advanced further than those 62, 63 miles.
Right.
Did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, actually, you bring up a very good thought that you bring up a really good point that I didn't even think about was Mussolini basically had to threaten him with his job before he made any movement at all. Okay. So he goes into Egypt. He's still on the outskirts. He hasn't really challenged the British, but you made a good point. It's not like he tried, he threw his forces at them. He got hurt and he got bloodied and he pulled back. I mean, there was no contest. He was basically, his artillery was bombing positions the British had already abandoned. Whether he knew it or not, he knew they were going to retreat in general because his reconnaissance was telling him. But you made a very good point. I mean, it's not like he tried, he got his butt kicked and then pushed back. I mean, he never even really tried. And that's the part I really didn't focus on in those two episodes, but I guess I should have, that, oh my goodness, this guy just didn't. He had all these forces, he had all these weapons, he had double the artillery, had a bigger and better air force. But here's where it really gets interesting. The longer that he waits, the better the British get in their positions and their manpower and their tanks and things like that. So the longer he waits, the worse it would have gotten for him if he had attacked. So the real weird irony is that if he had hit early on, even if he would have lost a lot of men, which no one likes to do, he had the numbers, he could have taken losses and still pushed on the British line and pushed them back. But every day that he waited, it would have been worse and worse for him.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess at the end, it's best that he, after a certain point, that he didn't do it at all.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe he hesitated and then he just thought, well, I've hesitated now, so now I definitely can't move. But he certainly didn't try and blitz. Even if, like you mentioned, he may have lost a lot of men if he just threw everything at the British. This was not a guy who was renowned for sort of caring for human life. I'm not sure whether that is explicit to the lives of his enemies. I'm not sure how much he cared for his own troops. But it's certainly debatable. He was certainly an unpleasant guy and a staunch fascist, because I think he stuck with Mussolini to the bitter end.
But he was politically shrewd enough to keep up his pretense of, hey, Mussolini, I'm going to go. I'm going to, once this road and my water lines are secure, I'm going to move. But so at least he was shrewd enough to at least go through the motions of saying those things.
Yeah. That thing about the water lines was interesting as well.
Because
you've got to think, getting supplies, when you're trying to wield an army that's really quite big, it's got to be tough. So you've got to have like your fuel and your water lines brought forward. That made me think, like, maybe he's just like an old guard kind of guy, too sort of entrenched in the First World War style of fighting, and he just never got the blitz mindset at all. So he was never going to attack the British like in any significant fashion. Maybe he was just waiting for them to attack him so he could wear them down. I don't know.
Right. But that was not his orders from Il Duce, and he just clearly wasn't going to do what was expected of him. But then again, he wanted the position and everything that came with the position. He just wasn't willing to, or he wasn't going to do what he was told to do. And he should have been, replaced with someone else, but that's where Mussolini's flaws come in.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, actually, because it was the 10th Army under Balbo originally, but then I heard...
Right.
He got killed in a friendly fire incident or something.
Yeah, his plane got shut down by Italian AA fire, and Balbo was a lot more of what Graziani wasn't. He was certainly more driven, he was more organized, he was more of a professional soldier. And if he had not had died, he had led the 10th, and he would have hit the British early on. It could have been a very different story for a very long time, but fate, or whatever you want to call it, he was removed, and the Italians had to deal with Graziani.
Wow. Yeah, that sort of opens up an interesting what-if possibility.
Exactly. They might not have needed Rommel, so you never know. You never know.
Yeah, there was a... Because I've got a book here, which is a collection of essays called, like, What If? And one of them, I went straight to the Second World War one, of course. And it's actually written by John Keegan.
Nice.
Yeah, he's a tremendous writer. And he's writing about how Hitler could have potentially won the Second World War. I know this is sort of going sort of beyond the scope of this, the topic for this podcast, but hey.
Sure.
Just edit it out if you like.
Exactly. Exactly.
But he says that basically, Hitler should have, if he would have given significant enough forces to Panzer Army Africa, and he could have driven the British straight out of Egypt and up into Syria, connected up with maybe the Vichy French up there, and just driven across to Iraq, where there's loads of juicy oil just waiting for him.
Oh, yeah.
In any significant force, like the British probably couldn't have done much about it.
And he didn't have to hit the Soviet Union when he did. He could have waited a year or two. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, because then Germany would have been in a very interesting position to actually take if they'd driven up to the Caucasus as well, they would have been in a very interesting position to actually do the world's biggest encirclement maneuver on Russia. And, it makes you wonder what could have been. Especially if the Italians under Balbo had actually hit the British hard and fast, it's difficult to see how well how different things would have been, because the Italians, despite their reputation, could actually fight when they were
under Rommel. Exactly, when they were under Rommel, they did. They met his expectations pretty much, and they were fierce fighters under him. They just needed the right person leading the way, a professional soldier basically leading the way.
Yeah, it was about half of the entire Africa Corps, I think, was Italian. I think so. Mm-hmm. Not the Italian fighting spirit can't in the battles that were under Rommel can't really be ignored. Anyway, I digress, as I do.
Okay.
I'm going to look at my notes.
Okay, you go right ahead.
Was there anything else you wanted to chat about?
I think we put a good cap on that one.
Yeah, cool. It's kind of a tough situation. I mean, I don't know, it's difficult for me to, as a British person as well, like, what do you think about the Vichy French? It's a sort of semi sore spot, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely.
But I don't know exactly what the Vichy French were supposed to do, because they were kind of pro-Nazi, but...
Yeah, well, there were elements, but what it came down to for Churchill and the British was that you promised me, you know, Admiral Darlan, the in charge of the French Navy, you promised me you're going to keep this out of German, all your amazing ships out of German hands, but at the end of the day, they're going to be your political masters, so how can you guarantee me they won't get what you have when they're the ones who can take from you, you know, anytime they want? So the logic was just not there for the British. And so they did what they had to do, which you think would have given Hitler his answer even before he asked it. Okay, Britain, are you going to negotiate? Well, if they're willing to shoot on their ally 5 minutes ago, you know, they're in
they're
the fight.
They're certainly going to shoot against you.
Exactly. He should have known. Not that it would have probably changed much, but he should have known right then and there. Maybe tried Sea Lion earlier in the year, that kind of stuff, but he didn't, and that's how it went.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it looks like Sea Lion was practically impossible for him at any point.
Yeah, but he might have tried it, which if he would have tried it and it would have failed, I think it would have failed. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened for the rest of the war. I mean, you know, like you said, what if it quickly would have changed the entire scope of the war, and this could be a very different conversation we're having right now.
Yeah, very different. But, I do feel for everyone involved in that situation, because... Mainly for the French sailors as well, because to be shot on by the British has got to be a bit of a sting. They were given warning after warning, or ultimatum after ultimatum, which basically said, like, guys, please see this from our point of view.
Yeah.
We cannot allow the Navy, is from Britain's point of view as well, the Navy is what they've got. It's what's stopping.
Yeah, that's all they got at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Britain's always had a crappy army. The Navy's been their thing to sort of say, you know, right, come and get us. We've got an enormous moat, which you can't cross.
Right, yeah.
So Britain had to retain that. They absolutely had to. So they said to the French, give us your ships, you know, join us and continue the fight. Like, all of these perfectly rational and reasonable requests. And,
yeah,
and then they said, like, if you don't do that, it is with much regret. It was worded like this: it was with much regret that we will have to take matters into our own hands and basically put your ships out of action. So I don't know what they expected them to do. I guess that Vichy French were just calling their bluff and didn't work out so well for them.
Right. Well, what makes it hard to feel too much sympathy for Vichy is that when Poland was taken over, the government gets out of there. Okay, they're the government in exile. When Holland gets out, the queen gets on a ship and, you know, they go over there and they're in London or wherever, government exile. The Belgium, even though the king decided to stay there, the government said, okay, see it. They go to England, to Britain, and they're government exile. But the French don't do that. They stay there and not really join the Nazis, but there's a certain level of collaboration. And so they kind of get the reputation to a certain degree justly.
Collaborative.
Yeah, because everybody else took office and said, no, it's the principle of the thing. We're going to leave. We're going to go to Britain. We're going to still somehow resist you. And France did not do that. So it's tough for them. They're just in a very tough, almost impossible situation. They, just like everyone else, made decisions, and now they have to, at that point, they had to live with their decisions.
Yeah. I think as well that maybe an indicator of the amount that they were in with the Nazis, and I don't know how true this is. I think it is true, but I haven't got a source on hand, so I apologize to my French and Italian friends if this is wrong. But as far as the deportation of the Jews were concerned, Vichy France deported their Jews, but Italy did not.
Right. The Italians trying to, I don't know, the government under Mussolini trying to do anything in an organized fashion is very hard for them. But he literally would make a law, and then he would make a whole bunch of exceptions. Or if he said, okay, we're going to do this, the Jews are going to be this class citizens or whatever. If someone just came up to him and said, oh, my son or my daughter, and they would show a couple of tears, he'd be like, okay, well, this law doesn't apply to you. And he would write something out. And he made so many exceptions to his own law that there wasn't that consistency. But then again, you got to think in his own heart, he just wasn't hating the Jews or blaming them from all the world's problems like Hitler was. It just wasn't in him like that. And so you can't really expect him to pursue a policy that didn't emanate from him.
Yeah, he is such an interesting character. Ever since I heard the podcasts you did about him, I've been dying to see a movie of his life or read a biography or something, because he seems like such a complicated person who's not necessarily completely evil. But then again, maybe that's just because he's standing next to Hitler most of the time, and I suppose anyone's going to look good in that light.
Yeah, I think the worst thing, or probably the most accurate thing I've heard about Mussolini, was that he had the mentality and the personality of a used car salesman, but at the same time, he wanted to be a world leader. And when you put those two together, it just doesn't work. You've got to be bold and or ruthless, and he wasn't either one.
That the used car salesman thing does kind of fit.
Yeah. Don't trust him. You look at him sideways. I don't know.
That reminds me of another question I had as well, which was that why was he so interested, Mussolini, this is in sort of this empire building in the first place? Because this was at the time when empires were sort of, you know, kind of at the end of their lives or starting to sort of wither away, especially the British Empire.
Right. And it wasn't an empire that was held together by men. The days of an empire being under a single person are gone. It's like it's the British Empire, and they have all these possessions all over the world. You're right, it's coming to an end. But maybe he was a throwback to an earlier era. But again, it was he was an awesome dreamer, and he had this vivid imagination, and he just pictured Italian troops marching all over Africa and in the Middle East. I mean, it probably just sounded good to him. He probably imagined what he would wear and what the horse that he would ride in on. But you know, I mean, but that I think that's who he was, and it just sounded good. And since he's in charge of the country, you got to semi listen to this guy.
Yeah, and I suppose at the time that kind of rhetoric's going to appeal to a lot of people who don't necessarily think too much about, you know, what is this going to achieve for us? And where are the raw materials in North Africa? I did have a brief look for things like maybe they're looking for raw materials, but I couldn't really find any information about what his actual goals were besides take over stuff for no reason.
Yeah, when I went to Rome on my honeymoon a long time ago, 10 years ago, there was huge maps on the wall right outside the Colosseum, and you can see the Italian Empire and the Roman Empire at different phases. And I think there was just something like that. He just wanted to see a giant wall on the map, and it just showed entire huge sections of the map under Italian control, and it would just feed whatever he needed. And he was just trying to feed a need, and it was just on a very large scale because he was the leader of the country.
Yeah, just an ego thing then, I guess.
Yeah.
Because the reasons that the Romans managed to advance so far is because, at least technologically, militarily speaking anyway, they were far in advance of anyone that they came across. They just militarily could wipe out people.
Just a very sound military machine.
Yeah.
And by the time 1940 comes, the Italian people have changed a lot, and they're all about enjoying life and spending time with friends. And that's what I saw in Rome, and they just wanted to have a good time. And there's nothing wrong with that, because if we all live like that, hey, there's no war going on.
Yeah, which is great. In fact, that reminds me, my grandfather was in the original 7th Armored Division as well. He was involved in all of the stuff we're actually talking about.
Cool.
Yeah, I've got all of his possessions, his army stuff, including a completely authentic Nazi swastika flag, which freaks people out whenever you get it out.
I would imagine it would.
Yeah, it's very large. But he's also got I put together a photo album of all of his pictures. I do need to scan them, actually, and I'll send them to you. But there's loads in Egypt, absolutely loads. He had a serviceman's handbook. I think it was a North Africa specific one, and it talked. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was a "We Are About to Invade Italy" handbook, and I read just the very beginning opening monologue bit in it. And it made a point of saying that the Italian people were our allies in the First World War. And I just got the sense from it was that these people have been dragged into this war unwillingly. And, you know, let's all be nice.
Right. That's a very good point, though. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was quite a nice thing to say, considering you're blowing them up and shooting them.
Right. When I went to the D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia, there was a handbook for American servicemen who were about to land on the continent, and it was saying, if you are captured, these are your rights. And I couldn't help but think, well, you're fighting Nazis. You're not going to have any rights, but if you want to write a book, hey, that's fine. But, you know, they were fighting for everything, and so... I just found it weird that someone would sit down and take the time to write that book when you're fighting the Nazis.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, dying the hard Nazis, SS, if you came across them, as you know from your research on the Battle of France, that they'll lock you in a shed and shoot you, some of them. But
yeah, exactly.
But I get a feeling as well that some of the Wehrmacht were not quite like that.
Right, yeah. There were honorable soldiers, and then there was the SS, and, you know, it was a very confusing time, and everybody had to do the best they could with their decisions.
That's one thing my grandfather said about the Germans. I remember asking him once when I was very young, "Do you hate the Germans? Did you hate the Germans?" And he said, "No, I respected them." He didn't say the same about the Italians. He said they wouldn't fight. I thought to myself, well, yeah, neither would I, probably.
Yeah.
Different time back then.
So, right, different people.
Very brave people. I don't think I could do the same. Why did Mussolini decline Hitler's initial offer of panzers and aircraft? Again, that's kind of a hypothetical. You're not Mussolini, so it may be difficult to answer, but I guess it may come to the same thing we were talking about earlier, to do with it being an ego thing.
Yeah, I think it was. You know, by the time you get to episode 63, he's already officially turned him down. Mm. And not to ruin the story for anybody, even though we all roughly know the story, when the Royal Navy really starts hitting the Italian Navy in November of 40 and March of 41, that's when Hitler pretty much just says to Mussolini, okay, from now on, I'm calling the shots. You're going to do exactly what I say with your Navy, the whole thing. You're right in that he wanted a parallel war. He had his ego. He wanted his own empire. He didn't want to have to rely on anyone else. But at the same time, you've got to remember that Mussolini came to power years. He came to power, I think, in 1922, years before Hitler did. And so for the longest time, he was the big man on the stage. He was Mr. International, if you will, and he caused splashes all over the place. He was a big man, and a lot of people either respected him or admired him, even if they hated him or feared him. Mm-hmm. And so it's only 1940. Hitler's only been in power since 1933, but the war's only been going on for a year. And I don't think that Mussolini was ready to give up being his own statesman, being a great statesman in his sphere, and he wanted his own sphere, and he wanted people to come to him, and let him be their problem solvers because he was this intellectual. But he just literally wanted his own theater of war. It was to be a parallel, nothing more. Because if you think about it, if they had really talked and really shared with each other what they wanted and made appropriate plans, they could have been a lot more effective. But it gets to the point where the British, all by themselves, pretty much they hurt Italy, the Italian military, on land and at sea. So the Germans said, oh, my God, you're embarrassing us. We have to step in. And they literally did. And pretty soon the Italians were taking orders. I mean, that was – and to directly answer your question, Mussolini knew that if the Germans came in, you wouldn't be able to get them out. And he was right. Yeah. But he couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, it just makes me think that, like – well, initially what made me think of that question is – like you'd think that Mussolini was, despite his many deficiencies, he's not a stupid guy. He got to where he is because he's shrewd enough. And you'd think that he'd know, especially as a World War I veteran, he's an army guy. He knows the capabilities of the Italian army, and he probably knows that the Italian army won't be able to stand up to the British. And bear in mind that this is the Italian army that when he served with in the First World War, they got beaten by the Austro-Hungarians. And the Austro-Hungarians were the army that everyone else beat quite badly. Right. They're like, so that puts Italy pretty much at the bottom of the tier of effectiveness in terms of armies. So it just makes you think like that he would have what I would have thought he would have done was sort of been a bit more shrewd and sort of accepted some sort of assistance where he knows he's not terribly effective, and then sort of spun it in a certain way or used his political shrewdness to sort of bargain with the Germans, because it's really his army's terrible ineffectiveness which put him in the position where he couldn't refuse anyway. Maybe if he'd gone with German help initially, he would have had a bit more bargaining power when it came to saying, okay, you guys can leave now.
Exactly. Yeah. But you got to think that with Graziani just sitting there and Hitler comes up for the second time and says, hey, how would you like 100 or 200 Panzers? It would be like, yes, please. Thank you. I mean, you know, and hey, I'm going to offer you some planes to take on the British Navy in the Mediterranean. I mean, oh my God, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you take that? It's just the more material you have, the better, whether it's good material or bad or better than yours. But why wouldn't you take that? But you made me think of something else. In 1940, just because the Germans have kind of reversed fighting tactics and let's put our tanks in front, get them to smash resistance, and then bring the infantry up to hold and then send the tanks on more. I mean, this is still kind of new to everybody, and even the Germans, even Hitler was surprised and impressed with their own victories. And so maybe Mussolini is from World War One, and he doesn't really have a firm grasp about how ineffective his troops are going to be. Oh, so you just line up and you just attack. The Germans make it look easy, but you and I know there's tons of professionalism and organization behind that front line.
And we have hindsight.
Exactly. Maybe he just kind of sensed that, oh, that's how it's going to go. Yeah. And maybe he did not have a firm grasp about how ineffectual his own men would be against the British.
Yeah, and he did have overwhelming numerical superiority and material superiority already. So from his point of view, he may be thinking, what do I need any more, you know, artillery and troops for and aircraft? I've already got like the 3-to-1 odds that are needed for a breakthrough.
Right, but they never got a chance to do it, so because Graziani never, ever moved, except for backwards.
Yeah, good job there. I guess this is along similar lines as well. I'm sort of asking you to be psychic about foreign dead fascist leaders, which is tremendously difficult even for you, right?
Sure.
But why did he not move on Gibraltar? It makes you – although actually you did just explain that in your last podcast, but still it makes you wonder what would have happened had they sided with the Axis forces and taken Gibraltar. But I didn't know how much of a bad shape Spain may have been in after their civil war. They may have been in actually no shape to do anything about anything.
Yeah, but the truly ironic thing is that Franco's cautiousness actually, you know, he's going to survive the war. He's going to go on and he's going to be the, I don't know what to call it, dictator or leader of Spain for quite some time. So actually it's kind of ironic that he survives a war. He doesn't take anyone's side. But you would think that he would have said to Hitler, no, I won't join you, but I will give you permission to launch a raid against that British position. I mean, Hitler was asking, hey, why don't you join us? But he didn't even say, no, but I give you permission. He was totally... He had what he wanted, and everything else was just, I'll get it if I can, I'll get it if I can, if I have to work for it, if I have to earn it, if I have to cross that line, I'm just not willing to do that. But you got to wonder how much the American diplomat poured into Franco's ear about, hey, you know, look at the industrial might of America. You know, it's only a matter of time before we come in the war. You take that, you combine it with the British Navy. I mean, come on, you know it's going to happen. But he probably went there with those words from that diplomat, that ambassador, ringing in his ear. But at the end of the day, he had what he wanted. He had Spain, and he was just watching what was going on.
Yeah. It does seem strange, though, for a fascist leader to sort of stop and be content.
And absolutely.
Say, oh, I've got what I want now, and now I'm absolutely fine with it. And with regards to the American ambassador just saying, hey, guys, you better not do anything we don't like. That may have been the case, but then again, it makes you think about the consensus at the time was like, my goodness, these Axis, well, at least the Germans anyway, are pretty much unstoppable, and they're going to take over absolutely everything, especially after the fall of France. I mean, I can't even imagine what the shock must have been to everyone at the time that, like, Germany took out France in such a short amount of time. So I guess it's to his credit then that he didn't get swept up in the euphoria of the moment and just say, hey, yeah, let's invade everywhere because we're completely unstoppable. Let's attack Gibraltar, let's seal off the British, let's take all of their possessions and dismantle their empire and take it for ourselves.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, it's amazing that if he says no to Hitler when Hitler's at his height, it looks like Britain's about to fall or be invaded any day. France was knocked out in 6 weeks. The Italians are marching on, or, you know, supposedly marching on Egypt. If he's going to say no to Hitler in October of 1940, there's no other time that he would say yes, because this was the high water mark in so many ways. Obviously, yeah. The whole Russian campaign is still to come, but this is the high water mark. I mean, it looks like they can't lose even if they wanted to. And if he's going to say no now, he's going to say no forever. And you made another good point. You got Hitler. You have Mussolini. They're fascists. They're going to grab everything they can. Here's Franco with the title of – he had many titles. But if you call him a fascist and yet he refuses to march forward to spread the word of fascism or whatever, maybe fascist isn't the correct word. Maybe he's just a dictator of his country.
That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah, he's just, I got it. I'm good. Thanks, guys. Y'all have fun. You know, I got what I want.
Yeah, because ironically, if the fascist states had actually worked together more, they probably would have been stronger, which would be the fascist ideology, which they didn't follow.
Yeah, and we could be talking about a World War II that lasted 10 years, 15 years. But what it came down to for me, and this is truly unromantic in whatever sense that war, you know, battle is romantic, but the industrial base of the U.S. and Britain with its empire, I think, would eventually won, as long as Britain can't be knocked out, and for the reasons we've already spoken of, they can't be. I think the Allies would have won, but it could have been a very scary, much longer story with many more millions of deaths and suffering than what it was. And, you know, thank goodness that Mussolini was inept and Franco was cautious and just decided to stay within his own border.
Yeah, very much so. That reminds me, actually, there's one of the books I've got, it's out of print now. I think I told you about it. It's about that exact thing, about how the Allies' massive material superiority is really what won the war for them. Even the Allies themselves admitted that if they come up against the Germans in anything like equal numbers, they're going to lose every time. So right. You just have to sort of batter them down and batter them into submission with just overwhelming material superiority. It reminds me of it's a saying of, I can't remember who said it, maybe Michael Whitman or something, something along the lines of when they're talking about Allied tanks, it's just like one German tank can take out 9 Allied tanks, but the problem is there's always a 10th.
And that's all it takes, yeah.
Yeah. But there's the book is called Brute Force, And like I said, it's out of print. I've got a copy here. However, I've in the second-hand bookshop near here, there is another copy has turned up, which I can get for you if you like and send it your way.
Yeah, I think you need to pop over and go get that for me, please.
That shall be done.
Thank you. And
there was something in particular that you said that made me think of something, because I did some research on the Matilda II tanks, and they were so slow. It's this
right.
It's a shame. Like the Allies were, again, going back to this, how they won through material superiority, because their tactics weren't terribly great and their doctrines weren't terribly great either. Because here we've got a Matilda II tank, which is a pretty new tank at the time. I think it was designed in 40 or 39, somewhere around that time. but its maximum off-road speed is 9 miles an hour.
Right.
And when I just wonder if it gave them pause for thought when they're planning Operation Compass, and they've got lots of these lovely Matilda II tanks, but the Italian Air Force, if it just goes up and spots them coming towards the Italian positions, these tanks are going to be so slow because they were built as an infantry tank, I think, which is First World War style, which is completely
exactly.
outdated at the time. They're designed to just sort of crawl along with the infantry, which is why they thought the low speed wasn't too bad. But they've just got lots of armor and a fairly hefty gun on them.
Right.
Just, maybe they got lucky as well that the Italians didn't spot them, because if they'd have brought their air force down on all of those tanks, they could have done some serious damage.
What I think what is interesting to note is that the designers of the tank, even though it was the Mark II, the designers of the tank were going off of the experiences from World War I, and they're like, this thing, yeah, it may be slow, but it is so thick, it's going to be able to take a lot of damage and be able to, or a lot of hits and not be damaged, and get our infantry close in where they can do what they need to do. And the British are going to find out very quickly that the Italians bombing on land is no better than trying to bomb Italian ships in the Mediterranean. And two, I just barely touched it in one of the episodes, that the Italian tanks were so darn light that, just their anti-tank guns could puncture this thing. So if the Matilda can get a decent shot at an Italian tank, they're gonna destroy it, you know, with one or two shots or whatever. So, yeah, it's certainly not as sexy or flashy or as fast as a Panzer zooming through France, you know, knocking France out of the war, but it's going to get the job done. And for people who didn't know how the war was going to turn out or how it was going to be fought in World War II, they did a pretty good job of planning something they really didn't know how it was going to be, you know?
Yeah. But, that's true. They did have faster tanks as well, cruiser tanks, which were
right.
sort of zipping around. So, evolutionarily developing tanks and seeing what works best. It's just
And those got their butt kicked in France, and so those are pretty much going to be used for reconnaissance.
Oh, the cruisers.
The cruisers, because they were so thin and they couldn't stand up to the Panzers, and they said, okay, well, we'll take some to the desert, but this is pretty much to dash around, maybe put out fires and that, you know, that kind of stuff, firefights, that kind of stuff, but mostly for reconnaissance. Let's get in there, see what's going on, and get out, report it, and then send in the Matildas.
Yeah. You reminded me as well of the Italian M11 tanks. There's a program I'm fond of, the Battlefield series, which I just think is fantastic. And in one episode of that, the guy says with his wonderfully dry English voice, you know, that's completely factual, and he just sort of mentions in his factual diatribe how the Italian tank is, like, widely considered to be the worst tank of the entire war.
Yeah.
That's a pretty, pretty terrible badge of honor to be wearing.
There's no comeback for that. You're absolutely right. I have nothing to say on this one.
You talked about it in the podcast as well, about how you've got their main gun didn't move. I think it had like a 15 degree traversal on either side or something like that. It was pathetically small. It had no armor. It had a rotating sort of machine gun on the top, which was useful against nothing really. And they were wiped out. Some of them were captured as well, I think, and pressed into service by Australians. They painted some lovely big kangaroos on the side.
Yeah, please don't shoot us. Yeah.
Yeah, until they ran out of fuel and they just dumped them.
Right. But in Graziani's defense, he did have a mobile brothel with him when he was on. I'm totally serious. I'm totally serious. He brought that with him.
A mobile brothel? That's just a woman, isn't it?
Ouch. Well, it was several because there were other officers. But no, he literally, that was part of his entourage. I don't know what to say at that point. But
that's a better way of putting it. It's an entourage. Mobile brothel.
But, so he wasn't moving anywhere. His tanks were crap.
Women with legs.
He had priorities. He's Italian. What can I tell you?
My goodness me. That man's a strange fellow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember you saying that one of the first, they went to a town that had like one shop and two brothels.
Yeah, and he brought his own. So clearly, yeah. The Italians are fine. They're doing fine.
Yeah, maybe that's why he stopped. He was just relaxing.
He was busy
taking in the sea air. It's interesting. I'm still puzzled by the fact that why he would build a water pipe. I mean, do you think that was some sort of level of procrastination on his part?
I think so, and also arrogance. If you think you're going to be there long enough and literally take everything over and own it for the next 30 years, yeah, you're going to want a water pipe, but come on, this is a mobile war. It's 1940. Move, move, move. And he was just using it as an excuse. And I'm sitting there trying to think, and I am not an expert on this at all. I need to do research, but if you build a road in the desert and some wind comes along, doesn't your road disappear because it gets covered by sand? I mean, unless you make it like 15 feet high or something.
More than likely, yeah. Unless it's mounted on stone or something.
So what's the point? Maybe it was. I don't know. I don't know anything about this, and I'm sorry, I should do research.
Metal, I think? Metal grids, yeah. The temporary runways with sort of metal slates put together.
Exactly. It is, and I'm like, I mean, how is this road not going to disappear the next time there's a sandstorm or something? But again, I just need to do more research.
Yeah, it just seems the whole thing's a complete farce.
Yeah.
As well we know now.
An Italian tragedy.
Yeah. And I'm looking at a plan at the moment for Operation Compass, and their disposition is so strange as well of their camps. Where the Italians have got a whole bunch of camps that are completely separated by however many miles. I can't remember how many miles, something in the region of 20 miles or something like that, 20 or 30 miles between the camps on the coast around Sidi Barrini and the other ones in the southwest. Basically the huge gap that the 7th Armored Brigade or Division manages to drive straight through because they don't check.
Yeah.
Why would you pre-split your forces? Like, that's a gift to your enemy. Like, that's what armies usually have to fight to achieve, is splitting of forces.
But exactly. They did it for them.
Yeah. It looks like a trap as well.
Yeah, but it wasn't. It was a reverse trap. It was just incompetence. No, but what Richard, General O'Connor is going to figure out was all the tracks to the camps go in and out of the camp from the northwest corner. And he's thinking, okay, well, there's mines all other places except for the northwest corner. So that's when he makes his plan. He literally has all the tanks and the armor go in the northwest corner of each one. You think Graziani would have changed it up. Okay, in this camp, the access is over here. No, but it's all uniform. So it's like, okay, everybody go in the northwest corner. There's no mines there. Go in and just blow the hell out of them. And it freaking worked. But the Italians were trapped by the mines all other – the three-fourths – directions around the camp, you know, so it just worked. Oh, wow. And I'll go into great detail about that, but
yeah, so they attacked they attacked on the axis that the path was into and out of the camp, so the Italians would actually be trapped by their own minefield.
Yeah, you had to get by the British. So I'll go into great detail, but I'm like, oh my god, change it up, do something. But no, but still, Richard O'Connor deserves a lot of credit for coming up with that, for executing it. It was brilliant. And that's only the beginning of what Operation Compass does. And I want to, you know, we'll say that for that episode, but it's an amazing battle, and he pushes on them like no one ever thought he could.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing stuff. And he would be thanked by Churchill for it, I'm sure.
Yes.
Greatly. And yeah, that all turns out well.
Yes, it does, for the British anyway.
Cool. But the last thing I listened to was about de Gaulle in, was it French Equatorial Africa. He wanted to attack north through Chad to Libya.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's no roads, is there? Who's going to attack?
He's de Gaulle. He doesn't need roads. He's gonna take Gabon to the south to cover the southern flank, push through Chad, go all the way through Libya. As we all know, you know, it's mostly desert except for when you get to the coast or whatever. He's gonna push through that, and he's gonna hit the Italians from the south to hell with the British just standing there waiting. You know, the staring contest going on between the Italians and the British. He's just gonna push through Chad, push through Central Africa, the continent of Africa, and hit the Italians in the south, and he's gonna do it all. You just gotta love those the brass on that man. You just have to admire that.
I certainly do. I just didn't know if it was feasible or not. I assume it is, because, you know, out of me and De Gaulle, I assume De Gaulle knows more about military matters than I do.
Yeah, he was ambitious. He was gonna, you know, he was gonna do what he had to do to bring France back.
Certainly a surprise.
Yeah. No one would have expected that.
No. We'll attack them under cover of daylight. We'll never expect that.
Yeah, no one's going to look to the south. No one's going to look into the desert and expect to see the enemies coming at you. And so, hey, who knows? But that's what he was going to do. And
it's just such enormous distances.
Absolutely.
It's a problem when talking about the African theater as well. It's so easy to sort of lose track when you're looking at maps of just the enormous distances involved. And they're absolutely tremendous, as you know, like they ended up with the seesaw battle back and forth as like supply lines got overstretched because there's not enough ports on the North African coastline. In fact, I've got a little interesting thing about that, but it was about rules of thumb for supply. When supplies, I'll just read verbatim from a book I've got called How to Make War by James F. Dunnigan. Very good. Highly recommended. It says, when supply is moved by sea or rail, the fuel required is not a significant factor. To move a ton of material, 100 kilometers by train uses 14 ounces of fuel. A large ship uses about half that. When material is moved by truck or air, it's a different story. By truck, 1% of the weight moved will be consumed as fuel for each 100 kilometers traveled. By air, the cost will be from 2 to 5%, depending on the type of aircraft. And then it goes on talking about helicopters, but that's not really relevant. And again, this is for modern warfare, but I imagine the rules of thumb are very much the same. And that really comes into play in North Africa, where you see that there has to be these enormous, like, baggage trains essentially going like 1,000 kilometers over this single dirt coastal road on North Africa. And the forces just strike out as far as they possibly can. But then they just get overstretched, and the other guys obviously get closer to their port and their base.
Yeah, and then things go the other way for them because they can be resupplied. Yeah,
yeah. I just thought that was quite interesting at how stark the difference is between ship and truck.
Yeah, and all that again involves organization, timing, that kind of stuff, and not exactly the Italian strong suit. Because even before Graziani moves out, he's, you know, his supply lines are at least 350 miles. And by the time he goes into Egypt and adds 60 more miles onto that, I mean, you're just asking a lot, especially the times. And it was just that part of war, which is so easily overlooked because it's not romantic, it's not exciting. But it's essential, and if you don't have that all taken care of, everything else is going to fall apart rather quickly.
Absolutely. Do you know what the Italian situation was, what Graziani's supply situation was with regards to transports in the Med? Were the British hammering him at this point, or I think?
Oh yeah, his camps were being fired upon by Cunningham, who was just off the coast. It's not like the Italians could use their ships to sail on the edge of the Mediterranean and load them as close as they can. The British aren't allowing that, so it's trucks, and it's hard going, and that's where the Germans didn't want to get involved at first because they knew that resupplies and reinforcements would be hard and irregular getting to them, and they really didn't want to get involved unless they majorly got involved. And so that was the initial report they got back to Hitler, that their supply lines basically stank, and we don't want to be involved in this unless we're really involved in this.
Yeah, I suppose that for the Germans as well, like getting involved is not really going to help them unless I think the only thing they've got to gain is by driving all the way to Iraq and taking some oil, like we mentioned at the beginning.
Exactly.
That's probably a good place to wrap it up then, I suppose. No, nicely bookended, I think.
Well done. We mentioned it earlier. We mentioned it now. Boom, yep. We're done. Okay. But I really do appreciate you being on. And again, it's LukeWhitehorn.com. You can go there and see the things, pictures, but do not go to his website until you see the movie, unless you don't mind realizing what happens at the end of the movie, right?
Yeah.
Is there going to be an Iron Sky 2 with you as the main actor, the hero?
I am, I think, officially the world's worst actor. Okay. So that will not happen.
No. Okay. You could be an extra. Okay. But yeah, look, I do appreciate you spending time with us today. And if this podcast does last years like I think it's going to, maybe you can come on again and we can do this again in the future.
I would be delighted to do that. It'd be great.
Excellent. So thank you to Luke. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Episode 64 will be my interview with a professor from King's College London. I'll be talking to him in a couple of days, and I'll get that out to you. And then we'll get on with Operation Compass, probably episode 65, and we'll just see how much work I can get done during the holidays. So, as usual, take care, everyone.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.